Carol Burnett, Liz Calloway, Betty Comden, Adolph Green, George Hearn, Mandy Patinkin, Howard McGillen, Lee Remick, Liz Calloway, Erie Mills, Daisy Prince, Lillian Montevecchi, Phyllis Newman, and Elaine Stritch. These are just some of the beautiful people enjoying the explosive applause that you hear on this legendary recording of a legendary night of music making at Lincoln Center. This is a 1985 recording of Follies in Concert, a landmark recording that was produced by my friend Thomas Z. Shepherd. Hello, Tom.
Hi, Julian.
Wow, that's a happy audience you hear in that recording.
I've never heard anything like it in my life.
And that was the very first moment of the show.
It's the only moment of the show that I was able to witness. Even though I produced the concert, I also was producing the recording. And our sound truck was parked on the side street, and I had work to do. So I stayed in the house just for the thrill, because I had a pretty good idea what was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And after this extraordinary opening and the applause, I slunk my head and I walked out and I went back to the truck and spent the rest of the evening in there, watching it on a monitor, of course, but not being in the hall.
I'm Julian Fleischer.
I'm Tom Shepherd.
And we are talking about Tom's recording of Stephen Sondheim's legendary musical, Follies. Let's talk briefly, before we get into the recording, about this musical. The plot is pretty self-explanatory. It's a group of performers from the Ziegfeld Follies reuniting in the theater where they used to perform in advance of its destruction and being turned into a parking lot.
Exactly.
And it's a memory play, essentially, where these performers recall their past, their relationships with each other and to themselves. We see the younger versions of them, we see the older versions of them, and we learn their stories.
You also find that their memories are imperfect and that there are things that they remember in one way that, in fact, were quite different.
Now, the show ran for about a year on Broadway, but is not considered to have been a big success. Am I right?
Yes. The show did not play that well in front of the typical New York audience. And I think there's a reason for it, Julian. I think it's because the characters are largely unsympathetic.
Mm.
You may recall when Chicago first opened in New York, for very similar reasons, it was not a big hit.
Yeah, it was a little ahead of its time, in other words.
Exactly so. Sometimes we have to catch up to where the writers were.
Right.
So because of the nature of the material, although the music was wonderful, the show was, in fact, not a commercial success first time around. But it had its enormous bunch of followers. There were just people all over,
right,
you know, who knew how great it was.
Now, I was familiar, you know, growing up with some of the songs. There are some songs in this show that are, you know, legendary. But it wasn't until this album came out, this particular record that you produced, that Follies, I think, really found its place in the world as a masterpiece that everybody could understand. So tell me how this project was generated.
I was at RCA Records. It was 1983, I believe. And I had an appointment with Ted Chapin, Theodore Chapin, who runs now the Rodgers and Hammerstein office. After college, he became an apprentice to the show Follies when it was trying out in Boston. He wrote a whole terrific book about it. So nobody knows Follies, its ups and downs, its cut numbers, its restored numbers, better than Ted. And he knew, obviously, that I had spent so many of my recording days producing the cast albums of Steve's shows. So he came in to see me one day. He said, I have a terrific idea. Let's make, finally, a good recording of Follies. I said, I'd love to. He said, yeah, let's get the best people. We'll go into a studio and we'll make it. And I said, it's a great idea, but the truth is, I don't think I can get all the best people at roughly the same time in the same place. I said, why don't we see if we can't do it as a staged concert? And he said, well, that's a great idea. What do you have in mind? I said, well, I have a very good relationship with the New York Philharmonic. So I made an appointment with Albert Knickerbocker Webster, the manager of the New York Philharmonic. Pitched the idea to him, and without too much hesitation, he said, well, we've never done anything like this before. We've never staged a Broadway show. Let's give it a shot.
Is that true? So this was essentially the first staged concert of a musical?
To the best of my knowledge.
So this idea came out of your head sort of full-blown, like you had this image?
Yeah, but it may have come out of my head full-blown, but Ted pulled the trigger before the shot was fired. If Ted hadn't come in to discuss this with me, I doubt very much that I would have gotten to phase two on my own. So I have to give him a great deal of credit.
So before we get further into the story of how you built this concert, let's actually listen to another couple of these gorgeous tracks. We're going to start with Rain on the Roof, which is performed brilliantly by Comden and Green, who most people think of as songwriters.
There's kind of a Broadway family of people who really enjoyed spending time together, and that would include Adolph Green, Leonard Bernstein, Phyllis Newman, Steve Sondheim, Mary Rodgers. It was kind of an insider's club, and it just made perfect sense, since I knew from having worked with them that both Betty and Adolph were terrific performers, they would just be perfect as ex-vaudevillians.
They sort of are in their own way. They feel like ex-vaudevillians.
How true.
Great typecasting. Here are Comden and Green singing Rain on the Roof, a tune that Sondheim wrote to sound like a tune that this former vaudeville team would have sung in their heyday. It is followed directly and seamlessly by A Paris. These two songs form the first two of a triad of tunes that take these performers back to their heyday. But before we play the third one, we're going to take a little break. Let's listen to Rain on the Roof and A Paris.
Listen to the rain on the roof. Go hippity-tat, hippity-tat, babysit kitty cat. We won't get home for hours. Relax and listen to the rain on the roof. Go blink like a pool, crank like a pink line. Now let's have a drink and shelter from the shower.
For you, as neon, Berlin as bars. But Paris, Shanghai has silk and Madrid guitars. But Paris, when you cured after you have toured.
Hold it, because
we're about to hear Elaine Stritch singing Broadway Baby, and she puts her own particular spin on this. She sings it very slowly, as a matter of fact, and she's just hysterical. What can I say? Stritch is Stritch.
Stritch is Stritch. That is a truism, and she does own this tune. It's really hard to ever hear another person sing it, even though wonderful people sing it all the time. Jane Howdy Shell received a Tony nomination just a couple years ago for her version in the recent revival, which I thought was extraordinary, and I happen to know Sondheim was a big fan of. But when Stritch steps out and does this, a legendary moment is born. So I welcome you all to sit back, get comfortable. If you got a drink, start drinking it.
Because she already had a head start.
This is Broadway Baby.
I'm just a Broadway baby. Walking off my tired feet. Pounding 42nd Street to be in a show. Oh, Broadway baby. Learning how to sing and dance. Waiting for that one big chance to be in a show. Oh, gee, I'd like to be on some marquee. All twinkling lights, a spark to pierce the dark from Battery Park to Washington Heights. Someday, maybe, all my dreams will be repaid. Heck, I'd even play the maid to be in a show. Working for a nice man, like a Ziegfeld or a Weissman in a great big hall.
Was Broadway Baby, sung by the inimitable Elaine Stritch. The recording was produced by Tom Shepard, my co-host on For the Record. This week's episode is, of course, Follies in Concert, and in concert we are. The applause is a really big part of this record.
I kept the applause in whenever it was like a show number. Generally, I tried to make it without applause when it was part of the story number.
It sounds like an Olympic stadium of people going nuts. And frankly, it's not hard to understand why, because the layers for this audience and for that performer and that song and that composer are so thick. It's like a Swiss layer cake of ideas and history lessons and entertainment that it's almost unparalleled.
I think it is unparalleled.
Because that song, you can't imagine it wasn't written for her. When Elaine Stritch steps out on the stage of Avery Fisher Hall and says, "I'm just a Broadway baby," people are going to go nuts.
I think you've described the essence of Elaine Stritch. Almost everything she sings, you can't imagine that it was written for anybody else.
And in this case, the match of singer to song is perfection.
Fabulous.
And the orchestra sounds extraordinary. And she's telling her own story. This is Stritch.
And you're hearing that whiskey cigarette voice trying to sing the story of an innocent young girl.
It's so beautiful. Stritch is just one of the many inspired ideas that came together to form this particular concert. Tell me a little bit more about how it came together.
Stritch wanted to do it very much, and I think she actually phoned Steve and said she'd like to do Broadway Baby. We were, of course, delighted. She's so smart, so intelligent, and everything that came out of her mouth always sounded so original. I mean, she was just an extraordinary force of nature. And the rehearsals were long and they were arduous. They took place, you know, at the New York Philharmonic, at what was then called, I guess, Philharmonic Hall. And the rooms were hot. They weren't properly air-conditioned. One of my biggest memories of Stritch is that during one rehearsal, she felt very warm, so she took her top off. A sight to behold.
That's something only Stritch could really get away with, I assume. I mean, maybe not. I suppose if Barbara Cook wanted to take her top off, she would take her top off, too. Tell me how you came across the notion of Barbara Cook.
Barbara Cook was Steve's idea. He said he thought that she would be the quintessential Sally, which indeed she was. But Barbara hadn't been on the live stage, I think, for anywhere from 10 to 15 years, and she was very nervous about the whole thing. As a matter of fact, she wanted to make sure that she had a monitor loudspeaker at her feet so that she could hear the orchestra more clearly when she was performing. And I was dead against the idea because I felt that there was no way, except by some miracle, that that part of the orchestra that came out of the loudspeaker at her feet wouldn't also go into her microphone. So I tried to discourage her, and she was adamant. So, okay, so she had her monitor speaker at her feet. And then right before the first performance, she said, "I don't need this damn thing anymore." I said, "Okay, fine."
Good for her.
Yes.
I have to wonder, if you're standing in front of the New York Philharmonic, how it would be difficult to hear them.
Beats the hell out of me. I have no idea. But I think it was just nerves.
Just nerves.
I mean, Carol Burnett had nerves. She hadn't been on a live stage in God knows how long, and she was afraid she was going to forget her lyrics for I'm Still Here. So we put out cue cards outside of the wings on each side of the stage so she could look whenever she needed to get her words. She never looked.
Mm-hmm.
She just needed the security of knowing that the words were there.
The gap that you just described between these women's last live performance and this one, I think also serves to make their performances more authentic and match the characters more closely. You know, there's a sense of nostalgia, of distance that is very poignant when
yes.
you listen to
I
these.
I mean, there's a backstory to these people as people that has a parallel into the roles they're playing on this show.
Therefore, the casting is even more brilliant. And it's funny to think now of Barbara Cook, who performs regularly even now, and she's not young anymore, but her performances are shamanistic at this point. I mean, she gives the most beautiful performances in small rooms, mostly. I mean, I don't know when the last time she played a hall as big as Philharmonic Hall, but it's hard to imagine a woman as at home in front of an audience as Barbara Cook being nervous about doing something like this. Here's Barbara Cook, Losing My Mind.
The sun comes up, I think about you. The coffee cup, I think about you. I want you so, it's like I'm losing my mind. The morning ends, I think about you. I talk to friends, I think about you. And do they know? It's like I'm losing my mind. I dim the lights and think about you. Spend sleepless nights to think about you. You said you loved.
And once again, the audience goes wild, this time for Barbara Cook singing Losing My Mind, which is one of the quote-unquote hits from this show.
Yes, it is.
And her performance is crystalline and perfect. And you tell us, Tom, that we're probably listening to a composite of three different performances.
Yes, you are. You're hearing from the dress rehearsal, which our invited audience was instructed not to applaud. From the first performance, opening night, which was the one where Mandy actually went up on, where he forgot his words and had to go back. And then there was the second night. So we had two complete performances and a dress rehearsal, and I was able to roam freely between all three of them and get the best moments, the best phrases, the most accurate, whatever. So that what you're hearing is probably a little bit more refined than any of the three performances I'm referring to, because it's a distillation of everything they did.
Well, it's seamless. I wouldn't have known that if had you not told me.
You're not supposed to.
Well, there you have it. You win. You succeed. Now, We know that the cast included a bunch of extraordinary women, but there were also some extraordinary men. Mandy Patinkin, George Hearn, Howard McGillin. Tell me a little bit about the guys.
I knew many of these people from before. I had worked with Mandy on prior albums. I had even worked with Adolph Green and Betty Comden. So it was very comfortable for me to be in their presence because we were not being introduced. We had a history together. George Hearn and I had done Sweeney Todd in 1979. We did La Cage aux Folles, which I believe was around 1982,
mm-hmm,
which
just would have
been
before this.
3 years before this actually happened. So for me, it was also a reunion with people I'd worked with and that I liked very much.
So at the center of this pack of talented gentlemen is Mandy Patinkin, who is really riding a wave of extraordinary popularity as a Broadway performer at this time. So he's cast in the role of Buddy.
Yes.
And he has one of my favorite songs from this show because I guess it's Sondheim's ingenious way of encapsulating a feeling I'm all too familiar with, which is when someone you love tells you that they love you back and you just want to scram.
Yes. There are two women in this song that he loves.
Mm-hmm.
And the song was created for Buddy and two women. But Mandy went to Steve and said, look, I think I can handle the whole thing myself. So Steve said, yeah, give it a try. And Mandy did, and it's rather sensational.
Let's listen to Mandy Patinkin singing Buddy's Blues.
Hello, folks. We're into the Follies. First, old folks. Well, pause for a mo. No, folks, you still get your jollies.
It's just I got a problem that I think you should know.
Blues. Why don't you love me? Or you do, I'll see you later. Blues. Blah, blah, blues. That long as you ignore me, you're the only thing that matters. Feeling.
Feeling.
And if I'm good enough for you, you're not good enough.
Woo!
Thank you for the present, but what's wrong with this stuff?
Woo!
But don't come any closer, because you know how much I love you. Feelings.
Blah, blah, blues.
Those, if you will, then I can't. If you won't, then I gotta. Give it to me, I don't want it. If you won't, I gotta have it. High, low, wrong, right. Yes, no, black, white. Tell me that you love me. Or you did, I'll see you later.
It's a tour de force. It's bravura stuff.
Every performance on this occasion was just definitive. I've never known anything like it.
And the audience seemed to know it. Everyone who's had anything to do with this event remembers it like some kind of holy time.
That's right.
It seemed to encapsulate something. There was a lot of stuff going on, I guess, culturally. The city was, you know, in a bit of a tough spot, still hadn't recovered from the 70s. I think Broadway was still suffering a little bit. It hadn't been a great year. So there was something very galvanizing about this night.
I've never been to any other live performance that had the electricity that this does, or in fact, the love that you could just feel flowing back and forth from the stage to the people in the audience. It was a love fest from beginning to end.
Are you currently in touch with Sondheim?
I sent him something I wrote a few months ago, a piece of music. And I said, look, I'm sending it to you because I think I stole a phrase from Sunday in the Park with George. I said, so if I plagiarized, I'm sorry, but at least I knew who to steal from.
Uh-huh.
And a few weeks later, much to my delight, he emailed me back. He said, I didn't hear any plagiarism, just some lovely music.
Oh, that's nice.
Oh, it made me feel terrific because we haven't seen or spoken much at all in these years, and that he could be that gracious made me feel wonderful.
If you're just joining us, I'm Julian Fleischer. I'm here with my friend Tom Shepard. This is For the Record, and we are talking about Tom's extraordinary recording of Follies in Concert from 1985 with the New York Philharmonic and a panoply of super great stars. Now, you were telling me a moment ago, Tom, that there were some real challenges to putting this concert together.
It turns out there was, because even though Steve was enthusiastic, Steve is just part of the team that created Follies. The other equally important part is James Goldman, who wrote the book, who wrote the story. And Steve and James had not worked together in many years. I was told that there might have been bad blood between them. So what I really had to do was convince Jim Goldman to participate in this event.
If I may, just quickly, for our listeners who may not know, James Goldman is most famous for having written The Lion in Winter for Katharine Hepburn and Peter O'Toole, for which he won an Oscar, and also The Princess Bride.
He was an extraordinary writer, absolutely extraordinary, and a great treat to meet. But Jim's wife was not very keen on this project going forward. I don't necessarily know all the underlying reasons, but I can tell you that very soon after I started pitching this Concert of Follies with the New York Philharmonic, she said, "Mr. Shepherd, we don't give a crap about Follies." So I knew I had nowhere to go but up from there.
Now, I have to add, as I think you're aware when we spoke earlier, I know this woman of whom you speak. I actually, my first job in New York City when I arrived here after college was working as one of her two personal assistants in their apartment on Fifth Avenue. I never really saw Mr. Goldman himself. He was hidden in a room somewhere, I'm sure.
He was running away.
he was in some sort of veal fattening pen where he was being kept alive for the purposes of producing milk and other cash. But she was a tough gal to work for. I'm going to say it was one of the worst experiences of my professional life.
I'm not the least bit surprised. I knew I was in a hornet's nest because Goldman, who seemed like a terribly nice man, said very little. But basically, it seemed to me that whatever his wife was saying, that's what was going to go on. But as I say, I had nothing to lose to pitch further. So I concentrated on talking to Jim and telling him what we had in mind and who the cast were we had in mind and what kind of an event it would be. Within a week, he said, yeah, I'll do it, and I'll write new continuity for it, because we needed continuity. You see, when you do a musical with an orchestra and the orchestra is on the stage, you can't do the full dialogue that would have existed in a stage production because you can't keep 70, 80, 90, 100 players on a stage with an audience looking at them while they have nothing to do. So you abbreviate the plot in such a way that they're not sitting there twiddling or biting. And let's say after every 30 to 60 seconds of continuity or dialogue, the orchestra has something to do again. So it was James Goldman's job to write this continuity that would keep the thread of the story going.
So once he was on board 100%.
Not only that, but the two of them sat together during all the rehearsals, and they were best buddies. It's like time never changed, which was so good, in fact, that is when they decided, let's revive the show, put it on stage, and play it in London.
Ah. And speaking of things that are timeless, let's talk about Lee Remick.
What a gorgeous woman. Flabbergastingly beautiful. I think I don't even know that I spoke English when I was introduced to her. She was 50 years old.
And that's part of her job in this role, is to be timelessly beautiful.
Yes. What I did not realize, because the only thing I had ever seen her in previously in a musical was Anyone Can Whistle, and although I knew she could sing and act to some degree, I had no idea of the sophistication that she could bring to the role of Phyllis. I must say I was overwhelmed. And also, I believe she had worked with Herb Ross, our director, in the past. So Lee was very, very comfortable, and she was very, very terrific.
And this was my introduction, this recording, to this terrific song, Could I Leave You?, which is one of Sondheim's great waltzes and a really scathing tune that she delivers with such a light touch. You know, she's remarkable at walking that line between scalding you and making you feel lucky just to have her looking at you.
Well, I think the secret is that she really never loses her cool.
Right.
She's in charge.
Let's listen to Lee Remick, Could I Leave You?
Leave you, leave you, how could I leave you? How could I go it alone? Could I wave the years away with a quick goodbye? How do you wipe tears away when your eyes are dry? Sweetheart, lover, could I recover? Give up the joys I have known? Not to fetch your pills again every day at 5. not to give those dinners for 10 elderly men from the UN. How could I survive? Could I leave you and your shelves of the world's best books and the evenings of martyred looks, cryptic sighs, sullen glares from those injured eyes? Leave the quips with a sting, jokes with a sneer, passionless lovemaking once a year. Leave the lies ill-concealed and the wounds never healed, and the game's not worth winning. And wait, I'm just beginning. Oh, leave you, leave you. How could I leave you? Sweetheart, I have to confess. Could I leave you? Yes. Will I leave you? Will I leave you? Guess.
That's how it's done. Lee Remick, Could I Leave You? What a thrill. I'm just getting chills listening to all of these tunes.
Each song, in a way, Julian, each song is like a scene.
Mm-hmm.
There's a dramatic propulsion to each song, and you learn an awful lot about Phyllis by what she says and how she says it. And you also get a pretty good idea of what a loser Ben has turned into being.
Right. Well, in a Shakespearean fashion, his stock has gone down while hers is rising right in front of your face. It's thrilling to watch. Now, there's another sort of Shakespearean moment that happens in this show, and it's carried out by George Hearn, an actor of superior gifts.
He is so good that at the point in this song when it's part of the song itself, where the acting job is to act as though you've forgotten your lyrics and you're asking the conductor to cue you to give the lyrics, well, George is just so convincing that I am told that there were people in the audience who got very nervous and who got afraid that perhaps he really forgot what he was doing. But that is actually part of the song, that as Ben sings about his life and the road taken and the road not taken, he gets to a point where he can no longer remember the spiel that he was able to cough up in order to create the life that he did create, and he panics. And it's a great moment, and George, of course, is a marvelous actor.
Here he comes, Mr. Wiz. Sound the drums, here he is. Raconteur, au vivant. Tell us, sir, what we want to know. The modus operandi a dandy should use when he is feeling low.
When the winds are blowing,
yes,
that's the time to smile.
Oh.
Learn how to laugh, learn how to love, learn how to live. That's my style. When the rent is owing,
yes,
what's the use of tears?
Oh.
I'd rather laugh, I'd rather love, I'd rather live. In arrears, some fellas sweat to get to be millionaires. Some have a sport the devotees of. Some like to be the champs at saving postage stamps. Me, I like to laugh. Me, I like to live. Me, I like to love. Some like to sink and think in their easy chairs of all the things they've risen above. Some like to be profound by reading Proust and Pound. Me, I like to laugh. Me, I like to live. Me, I like to love. Success is swell and success is sweet, but every height has a drop. The less achievement, the less defeat. What's the point of shoving your way to the top? Living, laughing, loving, you're never a flop. So when the walls are crumbling,
yes,
don't give up the ship.
No.
Learn how to laugh, learn how to love, learn how to live. That's my tip. When I hear the rumbling,
yes,
do I lose my grip?
No.
I have to laugh, I have to love, I have to live. entire trip.
When the wind's blowing, chance to find a star.
She'll never take me back.
That's the point of shoving your way to the
Why
top.
Should she?
Living life and
what the hell have I done?
It's a brilliant take on the showbiz of showbiz, too, you know, because often the songs in this show are using formulas from showbiz music to tell the story of the people who made the showbiz itself.
Exactly. It's very well expressed. Yes.
It reminds me a little bit of Chicago in that way. And once again, it's very much a show about showbiz in which the people's lives mm-hmm. are told through the tropes of vaudeville and the vaudeville circuit. Also, that number reminds me a lot of Rose's Turn from Gypsy in that it is sort of an audio collapse.
Oh, yes, absolutely. It's a nervous breakdown.
Yeah.
You're right. I never thought of the connection before, but there is something in common called Stephen Sondheim.
Exactly.
He likes writing about neurotic people with or without breakdowns. But most of the characters in most of the Sondheim shows have some neurotic twist. They're not apple pie. They're not homogenized milk. They are unusual. They have demons. They have goals, sometimes at cross purposes with perhaps their better selves or with the people that they're involved with. But they are very, very three-dimensional, and they are adults.
Right, which is typical of plays in America, but not so much of musicals. I think people who go to musicals were typically accustomed to seeing two-dimensional characters.
Absolutely.
And then, you know, Kern and Rogers sort of opened the door, and then Sondheim walked through it and gave us a whole landscape of characters who are quite human, even though they're singing songs. And this show is really as much about memory as anything. You know, it's a memory play, essentially. And no song encapsulates that so much as I'm Still Here, which, even with all the other songs that we've heard today, is perhaps the most well-known and most beloved of the anthems that came out of this show.
We had Carol Burnett, who was delighted to participate in this. And I think she delivers an absolutely quintessential rendition. I think it's fantastic.
She was so beloved by so many people for her comedy, obviously. So to have her come out and sing a song that's full of poignance as well as comedy was really a revelation. It reminds me of when Mary Tyler Moore showed up in Ordinary People, you know, an actress we all think of as comic, giving a very deep and heartfelt performance.
Look, this song could have been sung by Elaine Stritch. I mean, the song belongs to a trooper who went from being an ingenue to being somebody's mother. I mean, that's the arch that is traced in I'm Still Here. She talks about what it was like when she began in the Depression, how her roles changed as she got older. But it's a song of triumph. It's a song that says, no matter what happened to me, I'm still here. I've still got it. Nothing's going to keep me down.
To be fair, Stritch has performed it many, many times. She has really made it her own as well. I have to say, though, this was the first time I'd ever heard it, and my eyes popped out of my head when I heard this rendition of this song, which has now, you know, essentially become a warhorse of the repertoire for anybody who sings anything from Broadway. So, Tom Shepherd, I want to thank you so much for sharing your experience making this extraordinary record with me and our listeners.
It's been a pleasure being here with you, Julian.
Thank you, Tom. And thank you to our producer, Ellie Smerling, and executive producer, Michael Shobe. For the Record is a production of WNYC, WQXR, and the Jonathan Channel. And ladies and gentlemen, I am Julian Fleischer.
And I'm Tom Shepherd.
You've been listening to For the Record, Follies in Concert. Let us bid you a fond farewell with the help of the great Carol Burnett singing the classic Sondheim War Horse, I'm Still Here.
Good times and bum times, I've seen them all, and my dear, I'm still here. Plush velvet sometimes, sometimes just pretzels and beer, but I'm here. I've stuffed the dailies in my shoes, strummed ukuleles, sung the blues, seen all my dreams disappear, but I'm here. I've slept in shanties, guest of the WPA, but I'm here. Danced in my scanties, $3 a night was the pay, but I'm here. I've stood on bread lines with the best, watched while the headlines did the rest. In the Depression, was I depressed? Nowhere near. I met a big financier, and I'm here. I've been through Gandhi, Windsor, and Wally's affair, and I'm here. Amos and Andy, Mahjong and platinum hair, and I'm here. I got through AB's Irish Rose, 5D on babies, Major Bowes had heebie-jeebies for BB's bathysphere. I lived through Brenda Fraser, and I'm here. I've gotten through Herbert.